Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm promising to do more on Twitter. So you may actually see, you know, posts on there more often than once every 3 months. Yes, we're here to talk.
Just hold your breath.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Look, I'm getting on Twitter right now. Also, I looked over the list of articles and I don't understand. There's no articles in here from Anton Chevakin or Daniel Meisler. What podcast is this again? I think I'm on the wrong show.
There is one from the Register, though. So that makes up for it. That's the trifecta. All right. First article is unpatched GPS tracker security bugs threaten 1.5 million vehicles with disruption. And this comes to us from Dark Reading and about 500 other news sites, because this was all over the place.
Yeah, you found a lot of articles on this. You put like 8 of them in the feedly.
Yeah. And I looked through them and I pulled about, you know, one sentence out of each one because there was, believe it or not, a lot of overlap.
Shocking.
But the gist of it, well, the gist of all of them, I guess, is there's a GPS device from Mycotis, I guess. I'm not sure exactly a GPS device from this company had 6 security bugs in it that would allow attackers to monitor 1.5 million vehicles that use the tracker or even remotely disable vehicles.
Nah, doesn't seem that bad.
Yeah, considering how many vehicles are on the road, it's not even a whole percentage. I bet it's not even a whole, it's not even a whole percentage of the number of vehicles in the United States alone, let alone worldwide, which is what this actually affects is vehicles worldwide. This is not just concentrated in any one place. And the 1.5 million vehicles is what the company claims the product has been installed on. And it's used by businesses and for fleet monitoring and for consumers for anti-theft purposes.
Yeah, this one's interesting. You can, if you look this up on Google and then scroll down a little bit, you can see it sold on
AliExpress, right?
AliExpress. Yep, that's where it was. And it sold on AliExpress. If you buy a bunch of them, you can get it for as low as $15. It looks like a car relay, but it uses GPS, LBS, and GLONASS, which is the Russian version of GPS. It comes with a prepaid SIM card. And it comes with a lifetime access to what looks like a high quality app for tracking, which has several functions. It has a bunch of alarms. It can tell you if your car is going faster than a certain speed. It has a shock alarm, which it advertises is for, you know, if somebody breaks a window. It has a geofence alarm if it goes outside of an area that you set aside. A cut wire alarm if somebody tries to remove it. You can query the location in real time. You can go back and look at the route of the history route playback and see where your car has been. And then finally, if you decide you don't like where it's going or if somebody has stolen your car, you can cut off the oil remotely because it's got 4 wires. 2 wires go for power and then 2 wires go to the oil pump. And you can turn off the oil pump remotely with the prepaid SIM card. And I frankly am shocked that this is $20.
Yeah, look at all you get for that bargain.
It is impressive.
You know, the shock alarm, at first I was thinking, man, electrocutes people?
That's the 6-wire version. Those wires go into the seat or the key, I guess. Oh, wait, no, most cars don't have a key anymore, do they? Dang it. But yeah, it's $20, although I'm guessing that at $20, they didn't have a ton of money to pay for security. I guess you had to pay $25 to get a secure version.
What you mean they crammed $20 worth of security in it is what they're saying, really. Yeah, I was going to ask a car guy about that remote oil cutoff because I'm wondering if that like would destroy the.
I was hoping you'd have the answer to that. Yeah, because you prevent them from stealing it, but you destroy the car. Like, what does your insurance say about that?
Yeah, it seems like overkill, but yeah, I'll probably ask somebody after this podcast, of course, so everybody will have to do their own research on that, but I'm going to find out. So BitSight is the company that discovered all these vulnerabilities in the product. And when they were doing their investigation into it, they saw 2.4 million connections to the API for this product from 169 countries worldwide.
I assume that's unique connections, since we were just talking about 1.5 million devices. That's not 2.4 million connections. That's 2.4 million unique connections.
When I read their paper, that was a little bit unclear, but I assume that to be the case as well.
Yeah.
But 169 countries worldwide, that is a significant portion of the globe, because I think that where there are 193 countries or something like that today. So that is virtually all of them. It's pretty interesting, pretty global reach as far as that goes. But they said that this product is used by 420,000 customers in multiple industries, including government, military, law enforcement, and Fortune 50 companies. It seems to be, depending on where you are, there's a particular use case per region for the device. So in North America, it seems like these are mostly used by the manufacturing sector. In South America, it's mostly used by the government. And then in Europe is where you got to get a hodgepodge of different uses, from finance to energy. And apparently the state-owned Ukrainian transportation.
That one's going to be real interesting. I bet the Russians are already kind of dialed into that one, because I bet that gives them some real interesting look at logistics.
Actually, that's something I didn't look into that I probably should have, is what that agency does. Because, you know, if you got information on, you know, DOT, Department of Transportation vehicles in the United States, that's like, not going to tell you a damn thing if it's of any import.
There's just too many of them going everywhere.
No, but I mean, what do they do?
Hmm.
You know, besides collect taxes on gas. I mean, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure what the DOT really does. And I suppose maintain the interstate highway system, which, depending on which state you're in, is, you know, let's say your mileage may vary on that. But they did all this research using what they called network traffic data analysis.
Actually, hold on. Before we start talking about this, yep. I'm actually super curious what Fortune 50 companies and what governments are using a $15, $20 device they bought off of AliExpress. Like, what kind of shady crap is this? Are they using the cheapest?
I mean, that could just be a gimmick of the article too, because you don't know if they're actually, that it's company policy to use that tool. Because if it's only fair. $20, in
someone
a lot
could have
of corporations,
just stuck it on there. All right.
Once you reach a certain level of management, you get a credit card, and they're like, you know, use this credit card for incidental purposes below $100 or something like that. So you could have some dude in the mailroom or whatever for their transport van go in and spend $20 using a corporate credit card for this thing. So I think it's probably more likely that it's really kind of a marketing thing for BitSight versus something huge companies are actually rolling out to their fleets.
Ah, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm just used to companies that spend way too much money on stuff and not buying something that's actually cost effective.
Like this.
Well, but then on the other hand, this doesn't seem to have any sort of corporate, you know, fleet governance structure either.
Like, the website itself is not designed around fleet management?
Yeah, like, does it have a way to, like, you know, group your cars into fleets and put them in, like, here's my North American fleet that I can track, and, you know, sort it into cities and stuff like that. It looked like a very simple app that was based around tracking one car, not tracking 20 and not tracking 100 cars.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Well, I would think if they were serious, though, they probably wouldn't do that themselves. They would tie into an existing fleet management software package and say, hey, this is compatible with this.
Well, that's, you know, it does mention that as an API, yeah.
So I'm not sure if it would be on the fleet management software's side to do the integration. That's where it would happen, or it would be on the product side to say, hey, you're compatible with, or where they just say, well, we have an open API and you can make standard calls that fleet management software does to this API in order to get the data to pull into it. I'm not sure which side of that thing would be on, because I have, you know, very rudimentary knowledge of vehicles in general, let alone actually fleet management. But as far as the vulnerabilities that themselves that the BitSight discovered, so we said there were six. The first one is a hard-coded device password on the API server. And this seems to be the most egregious one. So this allows you to gain complete control over any GPS tracker, access the location information, routes, geofence, location track in real time. And one article I read said cut off fuel to the vehicle and not the oil. But I think the oil is actually mentioned on the AliExpress, right?
Yeah, oil is definitely mentioned on AliExpress.
Yeah, so I think someone probably, one of the articles misconstrued oil and fuel together and put that on there. You could also disarm the alarms or other features. And this one I thought was very interesting, which I hadn't even considered, is reporting the incorrect location to the GPS server.
So that pretending like it's still geofenced, but you're actually driving it off somewhere else?
Right. So actually, I was thinking that this could actually be leveraged by the actual people who have the GPS tracker, if they needed for some reason to indicate that the vehicle wasn't somewhere that someone thinks it was. Now, well, if you put it in a nefarious context, let's say they put this on a company car and you've been given the company car to drive around and you plan on doing something nefarious,
no one
you hack
do that,
that in there. I'm saying the hypothetical you, not the Matt you.
Oh, you're right. You know, that guy's Matt, a jerk. Matt, who knows what Matt's, he would do?
Yeah, because Matt's a Boy Scout. He doesn't do anything nefarious. But then you could compromise this to say that the vehicle never left the geolocation of where it's at.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. So the next vulnerability is could send SMS commands to the GPS tracker without a password and run them as or with admin privileges.
Oh, that's silly. What can this do? It's just an attachment to your car. It can't do anything harmful.
Well, except for cut off the oil, apparently.
Oh no. Who would do that? Why would somebody set it up so you can stop a car remotely?
I know. Ask OnStar.
I know OnStar could do that actually.
The next one is a default password on the tracker itself. And this is the one vulnerability, if you will, that did not get a CVE number because they don't consider a default password an actual vulnerability. But you'll never guess what the password is.
Oh boy. What is
one
it?
Through six. So
it's
not
the same
even
as
eight.
My luggage.
And we'll go back to that Spaceballs joke.
Forever. We'll always go back to the Spaceballs.
All right. The next two are, or the next one is a cross-site scripting vulnerability on the main web server, which allows the attacker access to the user accounts in order to view the information that user has access to. Next one is there's an authenticated insecure direct object reference vulnerability on the device ID parameter, which will accept any arbitrary device ID without verification. So that's a vulnerability that's strictly restricted to someone who's already got an account.
But it just lets them pretend to get information from any other device. Is that what that does?
I think it means that if you were assigned a device, you can get someone else's device information because it doesn't verify that belongs to you.
Gotcha. And so you can buy one of these for $15 and then get information on everybody else's.
Right.
That's cheap. What a feature.
Yeah, they should be charging extra for that.
There's your fleet management. You only need one account to manage all your devices.
And then the last one is an unauthenticated insecure direct object reference that allows to generate Excel reports about the GPS tracker information. So you can use that to get the additional information about anybody as well.
Interesting. Anyone can do that. Wow. So they've never had a pen test. Like that default, that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 password on try. They've never had a pen test on this.
No. Well, it's like you said at the very beginning of the discussion, for $20, they're not spending a lot on security. They're checking to make sure, does it do what we're claiming it does? And that's it.
So, all right. So this is kind of a weird aside and I may cut this, but one of my son's friends is building trading bots for games like CSGO. And we were talking about it as we were driving to the mall the other day. And I was thinking about it because there's some interesting use cases here, but there are also some interesting, like, kind of security use cases, because apparently some of these bots can trade thousands of dollars of merchandise every day. And it's kids, it's like teenagers and like people in their early 20s that are writing these bots. And none of them are corporations and none of them have access to, you know, penetration testing resources. And like, this seems like about the same level as that. I don't know. It's just interesting. There's just like whole ecosystems of people that are writing code that just exist completely beneath the level of our security apparatus. Like people talk, the Metasploit thing, you must be this tall to ride this ride line of the internet. Like there's just tons of people that exist behind that, underneath that line, that we're just not even seeing at all. I don't know. I don't even know where I'm going with that thought.
Well, so, I mean, that's the double-edged sword of the low barrier entry to do these kinds of things.
Yeah. Anybody can create code, but anybody can create code.
Right. So you get a lot of innovation there because you don't have that high barrier to entry for really smart people to get in and start doing things, but it also comes with its own risks with having that low barrier to entry. All right. So according to the article, at least so far, they've not observed any signs of this vulnerability being exploited.
That'll change.
That will change after this article has been published, because these CVEs are probably not going to be addressed by the manufacturer. So BitSight contacted them in September of 2021, and it seemed like they got an initial response from the vendor asking for additional information. But once that was provided, any subsequent attempts to contact the manufacturer have been met with basic stonewalling. No additional communication back forth at all. Well, I mean, if they got what they needed in order to fix the vulnerability, maybe they didn't need to talk to them anymore.
I don't know.
It's wishful thinking, but I look for a potential positive in there, which is probably not too great considering what BitSight did after that, which is in January, they handed all this stuff over to the DHS and asked the DHS to engage with the vendor. So I'm sure that went over great. DHS calling up the vendor and threatening them to fix the problem or whatever or else. So I'm sure that really helped a lot.
No doubt. So why does this matter? Well, IoT device remediation is way flipping harder. These devices have no way to remotely patch. Yes, they have a SIM card in them, a prepaid SIM card. And obviously the API server that they dial into, the vendor can patch, but the devices themselves, the default password on the device itself cannot be fixed. There's no over-the-air update. $20 apparently does not buy you over-the-air updates. We talked about this before. When you're buying the cheapest possible device, you're not necessarily buying security, apparently.
Right. Yeah, I wish I would have thought of this before we started recording, because I could have looked into it a little bit more, but there are actually IoT frameworks that are currently being put together by Microsoft and a conglomerate of other organizations to make the security of IoT better in general if people adopt these IoT frameworks when they build their devices. So this, I think, you know, IoT is going to get better with time. It's just that between now and then, there's going to be some huge risks involved with the insecurity in IoT devices.
Yeah. So what you should do about it, if you are using this either on your personal vehicle or you're using it in a fleet in your Fortune 50 company, you should remove the MP720 device or remove the SIM card from the device and probably toss it, since you cannot update it over the air. I guess there's got to be a way to exploit the hard-coded password on the device remotely. They didn't really provide any details on how to do that, but I guess there's got to be some way to exploit that.
I'm sure there is. If you, in one of the articles, which all of will be linked in the show notes, of course, there's a rudimentary communications diagram in there that shows that there is direct mobile to device comms for that. So I assume that is where that would probably take place at.
Gotcha. That makes sense. And consider the next time you're looking to buy an IoT device or a suite of devices, how are you going to update it when something like this comes out, and what the potential impact may be if you can, you know, shut down your entire fleet remotely? Perhaps somebody else could as well. And what you might do about it. Maybe think about buying something that's a little more expensive that allows over-the-air updates. Perhaps.
Yeah, really what you want to do when you buy an IoT device is do a threat model. You're going to want to do a threat model for the IoT device to consider what the possible downsides of that device are. So if you have an IoT device that's a light bulb, you know, threat model that out.
Flicker your light bulb and distract us while we work.
Well, also it could be the way into the broader network.
Yeah.
because it is an endpoint on there. So, you know, threat model out what the risks are with the IoT device. Because if you have an IoT device that's hooked up to your car and the only thing it can do is turn on the windshield wipers and it doesn't connect into your home network or any other aspects of the car, you know, the threat there is a lot lower. So just take some time and consider the threat model for whatever it is your device does and where you're going to place it in the network or in relation to yourself and your other toys.
All right. Article number 2, Russian hackers tricked Ukrainians with fake DOS Android app to target Russia from the Hacker News. So at this point, a lot of people, I'm sure, have heard of the IT Army of Ukraine Telegram channel, where daily DOS attacks are arranged at Ukrainian websites. They post a list of targets where they, you know, point a bunch of teenagers and bored people using pre-built tools to run the denial of service attacks. These are generally not black hat hackers. It's people that are learning a new skill set, and I use skill set very broadly because, again, they're usually instructed to use these sort of pre-built tools or websites to run these DOS attacks.
Yeah, so teach people how to use a mouse. Click here.
Yeah.
Move around, click there.
It's like that, what was it, low orbit ion cannon or something, LOIC from the last decade or so. Yeah, it's people that are like, yeah, I'm a hacker. And sure, buddy. The Russians are taking advantage of this, and they have released a new Android app that they are marketing as a denial of service tool for Android called CyberZov. But it is actually malware that gathers information about the people who install it. It is pretending to be the Azov Regiment, a National Guard unit of Ukraine.
Yeah, the Nazis.
Are they actually Nazis?
Yes, they are actually Nazis.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I can probably send you a link to that video. There was an American journalist in Mariup who, after the Azov battalion abandoned Mariupol, he went in there and was filming the Azov Regiment barracks. And there's all sorts of Nazi stuff all over the place in there.
I'm reading the Wikipedia article, and we all know that Wikipedia is a 100% true. And I know it's better than like the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's on par with Britannica.
Yeah. Founded in May 2014 as a volunteer paramilitary militia to fight pro-Russian forces in the Donbas War, and it was formally incorporated into the National Guard in November 2014. Strong controversy for continuing association with far-right groups and neo-Nazi ideology. It uses controversial symbols linked to Nazism. And it's a part of a larger Azov movement. Interesting. Things I did not know. Anyways, it advertises itself as an incredibly simple app. You just install, open, and press start to punish those nasty Russians. You have to be pretty credulous to let somebody basically take over your phone to DOS someone. It says nothing about like target lists or, you know, pick who to target or select a target. You just hit the press start button. There's another one called stopwar.pro that also does this, which again tells you kind of the intelligence a lot of the people that are joining the IT Army of Ukraine. Although stopwar.pro does at least tell you to turn on a VPN first.
That's helpful.
I mean, at least it's a little helpful. It's, you know, it's a tiny bit helpful.
Yeah, this one thing that really bothered me about these articles is, and it could just be my own perspective on it, which is why I'm bothered by it, but almost all three articles seem to be worded in such a way to say, this app bad, this app good, as if encouraging people to use the Stop War app. In the one of the links is in the show notes will be to a Bitdefender article. And Bitdefender actually had the hyperlink in there for you to go to Stop War to look at this app for doing the denial of service. Because they're saying that the Stop War app actually does the denial of service that it claims to do, but this Azov app does not.
It, both of them seem a little, shady. I wouldn't trust anybody to install something that's not on the pay store that could be doing anything.
Right.
It may be DOSing Russian websites, it might be DOSing Chinese websites, it might be DOSing US websites.
Well, it's like
might not be DOSing anything at all.
Well, it's like pulling software out of Tor, right? It I would say it's buyer beware, except for you're not buying. Yeah. And it's the same thing here, where, you know, you want to do something that's, I don't know, whether you think it's correct or not is, you know, up for debate, I think. well, whether you really should be doing something like this, but you know, you're doing something that could put you at risk, you know, or is that really a good idea to do that or not? And apparently links to either of these two apps are being sent around on messaging apps, I assume like Telegram or Telegraph.
Yeah, they didn't say which one, but I would assume that as well. They also didn't describe exactly what the app does, but I actually would be super, I wish I knew more about reversing Android apps, because that seems like that would be a really interesting exercise to actually dig into both of them and just figure out what each of them does. But the CyberAzov site only visits the Russian website it claims to be attacking once in an apparent attempt to gather information about those pro-Ukraine activists.
Yeah, there was in the... None of these articles indicated, like you said, what the app does, though. You know, the only thing it said was it makes one call to whatever site, and that's it.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, is that really a lot of valuable information that the Russians would be collecting if all they're getting is the IP address based on that connection?
It's got to be collecting more than that somewhere.
Well,
because that's not even, because all that is that's not even an app. That's like a, it's like a browser plugin or something, like to redirect you. That's like a frame around a browser.
Right. Which is why it seemed, you know, why was there not more detail in any of these articles about what it actually did, what information actually collected from a user? Because I'm wondering if maybe this just wasn't really crappily written, you know, that they meant to actually build an app that does denial of service, but they did not write it. There's an error in our code that only makes one request instead of a whole bunch of requests.
That's hilarious. I mean, yeah. Start and it hits it once and all right, we're done.
Woo-hoo. Yeah. Like there's an error in their loop function or something and it fails to repeat the
condition.
The get request.
Yeah,
or
when it checks the condition for the loop to see if it's up or down, like they check it and they check for up instead of down or something. And they're like, success.
Right. Exactly.
I don't know. Yeah.
Because it seems like there'd be a better way to do this if the Russians were looking to collect this kind of information or collecting just the IP address, assuming that, you know, the information, but the detailed collection that's actually taking place on the phone is or is not happening or isn't happening. And I was also thinking, you know, if you know, what's your target use case if you're the Russians where you build this app and you expect people to install it? And to attempt to do this denial of service, you're not going to get the serious people that you'd probably really be interested in, right? You're getting, like you said, bored teenagers and stay-at-home people or whatever who feel like they need to get involved. So they're going to get this app. They don't have any technical skills. They have no really affiliation with the government or the military or anything like that.
They're going to find some fake meaning in their life by hitting the button.
Right. So what does the Russian side gain by putting out this app and getting information on these kinds of people? It just seems really weird to me. The target use case there doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Of course, there could be something I'm missing here, but it just seemed weird.
That's a good point. I don't know. I mean, it might be that it's just poison the well, kind of. So for people going forward to be like, I don't want to install this. Remember how the last time we did this, maybe people weren't really supposed to install it. Maybe it was supposed to be found out so that people going forward would be like, I don't know if this is real.
It's possible, because that's something I didn't look into, is what impact is the other effort having on the Russian side in the war? You know, is this IT army or cyber army or whatever the Ukrainian side calls it, is that actually having an impact on the Russians? Because if they are,
I don't know.
Then you could see where the Russians would say, hey, this is impacting us. How do we disrupt that? And maybe this was an idea they came up with, say, hey, well, let's poison the well so that people think or they're less trustful of doing anything that could have them participate in this because it could be, you know, the evil Russian. So what you're saying makes sense. I just don't know if they are concerned about the impact that's having where they would need to do that disruption.
I mean, I'm looking at the Telegram channel now. And there, so the latest, that was May 19th. That was forever ago. Hold on. My Telegram channel is not caught up. So it looks like May 19th, they were getting 87,000 views and 180 comments on their posts. Now they're getting 43,000 views and 60 comments on their posts. So it does look like it's dropped quite a bit, but they're still posting every day. July 20th, they posted a bunch of IP addresses and Russian websites. So there's still got people joining. I don't know how much impact. None of these seem really related, though. I mean, this is photo-gamma.ru, scalemafia.ru, kremlinstore.ru. Like, none of these are military-related. kstore.ru, they're just being an annoyance to Russian-related websites.
Or Russian people.
Basically. You're Russian, therefore, again, punish the nasty Russians.
Yeah. You figure if they get 40,000 people hitting the site, how many of those are actually taking action? 5%, 10%?
Generally speaking, for social media, the percentage is 1%-ish. 1% of people that see your post will take action.
Okay, so they got 400 people then.
Yeah.
That are actually doing something with that. I highly doubt that's even impactful then.
Probably. I don't want to dive too deep into it, but super interesting. I think this is cool because it's Intel Judo. It's taking something the other side does and then using it against them. I think it's super clever. I think it's having enough of an effect that the Russians took some time to do something about it.
Well, assuming it's not a legitimate guy that just messed up his code.
That's fair. That'd be hilarious if the guy that rolled it out is sitting there being like, shoot, they thought this was the FSB. he's just like, don't say anything. Don't say anything.
Maybe just quietly walk away. Hopefully he doesn't get a missile or something.
What should you do about it? Don't just flip and install things. And also, I had a serious question about this. Does, if you join in on denial of service as part of an ongoing war, does that technically make you a combatant?
Yeah, I was thinking that along the same lines. You know, these people, they're basically being couch mercenaries. You know, they're sitting there with their solid snake bandana and their smartphone.
Hitting a button and being like, yeah, I'm in the fight.
You know, without be laughing. Considering the broader potential repercussions of doing this kind of stuff, because both the United States, at least the United States, I'm not sure if Russia's come out with, I assume they have, saying that certain level of cyber activity will get a kinetic response. So thinking this through, though.
I'm sure they're not going to send like an assassin to shoot everybody in the head. But what if they did that for like 5 people and publish that? Like, if you join in on this, this could be you.
Oh man, that is just like Daniel Suarez's Freedom, where the demon's champion goes around, shoots those dudes in the office, and then leaves that laser light show that says spammers will die.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, it is. Yeah, you don't have to kill them all. Like, you just have to kill enough that everybody else quits.
Right, and make a display of it so everybody hears about it too.
Yeah, interesting.
All right, so don't be a couch mercenary. Be careful. All right. Next article. Can encryption key intercept solve the ransomware epidemic? And this comes to us from Security Week. And this is more one of these articles that was kind of along the lines of a marketing shtick than a legitimate article. But the concept here was pretty interesting. So Matt and I wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, we love ransomware.
Everybody's a fan of ransomware. But there's a company out there. Hey, what is it?
I didn't even write the name down.
Here it is. Nuvea.
Nubeva?
Nubeva.
Yeah. Right. So I actually looked up the company, and 3 years ago, they were doing like something cloud related that wasn't successful. So they pivoted into this ransomware thing. It's a company in search of a solution. They didn't start up to do this ransomware thing. They were doing other stuff before.
Yeah.
Not that that should matter. If they have a good solution, they have a good solution.
Right. And a lot of startups never succeed with their first idea. I listened to an interview with one of the venture capital folks that funded Airbnb. And those guys had pitched something else entirely on their first visit. And then they pivoted into Airbnb. But anyway, this company provides an agent that you install in your systems. And when it detects anomalous or mass encryption events, it intercepts the encryption key in memory, and then it stores it somewhere else on the device and also sends it to a server. And the company claims with this key, they could build a decryptor within 48 hours to then unencrypt your entire network or your entire infrastructure should the ransomware be successful.
So there's another article they posted, and I think the Financial Times, where they said that they recently did a third party test with thousands of samples from known ransomware families, and they successfully intercepted the key 96.84% of the time. I wonder if they offer a refund on the 3% of the time they fail.
Or maybe they're insured.
Yeah. Just like, sorry, bad luck. Hope it works next time.
Yeah. Because it's one thing we don't know. And they mentioned in there that they've got some kind of proprietary secret sauce that they're using in order to detect the encryption event. You know, for that other 3%, for some reason, they didn't detect the event or were unable to capture the key.
I wonder how they figure out the key specifically. Because they've got it.
I don't know. That's their secret sauce, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Because I can see how they can tell when there's mass encryption. Like they could probably, there's probably some machine learning for, you know, file accesses, a whole bunch of sequential file accesses or file rewriting or something like that. That part's pretty easy to see.
Right.
But how do they tell? I guess, you know what? I bet encryptors all work in kind of the same way. And I bet there's a similar point in the encryption process where the session key is used. But that's going to force attackers to rewrite their encryption process potentially. And then this is going to stop working for a little while until they figure that out.
And then it's the arms race we talked about last week.
Yeah. Well, interesting.
But still, I think the concept is really good. And, you know, this just needs to be incorporated in at the OS layer.
Yeah. The question is it going to be Microsoft that buys and incorporates this into Windows, or is it going to be another endpoint vendor like CrowdStrike that buys it first?
I'm not sure. In the article, they actually said these guys are not the only ones to do this. There are other companies apparently doing this.
I missed that. How have we missed that?
Yeah, it's at the very end.
Huh. This is a very salesy article. I actually looked for like a paid for buy at the end because it read as a advertisement for the company.
But once the OS vendors start doing this kind of thing and it gets widespread adoption, because let's say they are successful 96% of the time. That means that the ransomware gangs are going to fail to get their ransom 97% of the time or 96% of the time. That would take a huge chunk out of the ransomware market right there. If they go through the work to deploy ransomware and only 3% of the time are they going to get a payout?
Well, less than that, because a certain percentage of the time, those people refuse. So it'll be like 1.5% or 1%.
Right. So that's going to have a huge impact on the ransomware market itself. And while even an imperfect solution could lead to the demise of ransomware.
Yeah. No, that's fair. Provided you probably don't have
ubiquitous adoption, right?
Yeah. You probably don't even have to have ubiquitous adoption. I mean, how much less profitable do you have to make it so that the gangs kind of fall apart?
Right. Yeah. It's almost like the concept of herd immunity. Once you reach a certain threshold, right, you don't really need to surpass it because that's enough in order to impact the way that everything else works.
Yeah.
So this would be, once we reach a certain threshold of ransomware immunity, herd immunity, then you're going to see the same impact cascade out down to the environment.
Yeah, you'll probably see some weird side effects though. Like for example, if you know, like the Fortune 200 companies buy this first, you'll see attackers pivot first. And then as it sort of cascades into other companies, and then you'll see the gang start to fall apart as they're not getting their $100 million paydays anymore. And they can't, you know, buy their mega yachts.
Well, I think if you look at the current ransomware targets, you know, where they're presumed, they're not
targeting the Fortune 200s anyway. You're right. It's hospitals and city governments and school districts.
Right. So that's really where these guys need to start targeting their product at. They need to target, you know, Linus Torvald and Microsoft and Tim Cook, you know, get those three guys thinking about incorporating this or building their own for, you know, whatever, doesn't matter. When you get those three guys on board, then they build it in the operating system, then it just gets out there. But if they don't get the buy-in for the OS vendors, they really need to start focusing on those organizations that are really being hit hard. As a matter of fact, in the article, one of their anecdotal stories was a company that got hit three times with ransomware last year. And then they went to these guys and they were able to successfully prevent the fourth ransom infection.
After the second or third time you get hit with ransomware, I'd just be like, let's just unplug from the internet and let's just take a breather and let's figure this out first.
Well,
before we plug ourselves back into the internet.
Well, rather than unplug, they went to these guys, which seemed to have worked.
It's ridiculous. We got four times in a year.
I know, it's terrible.
Job security.
You know, the question would be then, so is that four different CISOs?
I would love to work on the IR team there. That would be a very like fun-filled and like Well, maybe fun's not the right word, but imagine that's like 3 years of IR experience packed into 1 year.
Well, look at it this way, though. That's really nonstop. Because if you had a ransomware event.
Oh, yeah. It takes months to recover.
Right.
It's just one right after.
Exactly. So you just finished the last one. It's like painting the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, you start back over on the other side. Yeah. Wow. I lied. I wouldn't really want to work there. No. But that's So it's interesting that they mentioned it's not an instant decryption. Like, even though they get the key, they can't just immediately decrypt. First of all, they need to let the IR process work because you need to kick the bad guys out. You need to figure out how they got in. You need to close the door. You need to make sure you're not restoring right back to an infected version that's going to kick you right back out again. The decryption process will take time. They say that they've got a 48-hour SLA to give you the decryptor. The decryptor, takes a little time to decrypt. It's not instant. But in comparison, they said that the average time working with the ransomware gang is 3 weeks to negotiate and get the decryptor. So it'll still be faster than paying the ransom and getting the decryptor. And I see this as an opportunity for the gangs to get better at their service. Just like a couple weeks ago when we talked about how they got better at getting access and moving from, obtaining access to delivering the ransomware. They knocked that timeline down real fast. They can also get better at delivering the decryptor. Yep.
Well, like I said, Yelp for ransomware. I'm telling you, got to get out there so that people know who they're dealing with and know who we get ransomware by.
Yep. I agree.
But the second use case that was in the article, I thought was pretty interesting, that there was a company who had already been ransomware. They were in the process of talking to the ransomware gang, and they went to these guys and said, hey, we've been ransomware. Can you help us? So what this Nubevius told them to do was go back and to the recovery process prior to the encryption was undertaken. And then when those systems are reinfected or encrypted, then we can capture the key. I thought that was a pretty good idea. So basically convincing the ransomware to kick off again, allowed their agent to catch the key, and then they were able to get past it.
And that is interesting. That's got to hurt to watch it hit again, though.
I'm sure they only did it with a small portion.
Two devices. I'm sure they didn't roll everything back and watch it roll through the network again.
Yeah, but once they got that key, I'm sure everybody was high-fiving and whatnot, though.
Yeah.
All right. And as we talked before about the challenges of even having backups, even if you have really good backups, you can still have your challenges with getting that. So the idea is to be able to either prevent the ransomware or be able to do the decryption rather than having to restore from backup. So obviously we are endorsing this product or whatever, but it's a concept that
we
had not seen before. We could if they were to pay a shitload of money. But I think this is an interesting concept that could be quite valuable. And if you're really concerned about ransomware, you might want to just take a look at this company and their competitors to see if this is right for you.
Yeah. I mean, it might make your C-levels happy. It's an additional layer of insurance, although your IT group probably would not be thrilled about yet another agent running on the machine.
Yeah. What is IT's problem with agents? You'd think they're all named Smith.
Oh, boy.
All right. Well, that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us, and follow us at SecuritySec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.